Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 467, which is Julian Levy, who is a visual effects executive producer. In fact, he was the producer, the VFX producer on The Creator, which, as you I'm sure know, was one of the films that was nominated for a visual effects Oscar. And it's really, really great to have him on. I think that visual effects producers are unsung heroes in some ways because, you know, a really successful film is largely based on how smoothly it runs. And that is solely in the hands of the VFX producer. And I really loved Julian's work. I've actually worked with Julian, we'll get to in a bit, but he worked obviously very closely with Gareth Edwards on The Creator, and we learned a lot about their process together and what Gareth did to make that work and how their meetings went. And in fact, producing visual effects has changed a great deal since I met Julian 20 plus years ago, which is, by the way, it was at Digital Domain, of course, and he was the VFX producer on my first film, The Day After Tomorrow, as well as Stealth. So it was really cool to be able to sort of reminisce about those old days and how Julian got there. So really cool background, really great story. Julian is a very charismatic person, a really successful person in visual effects, and really knows his stuff. And I really have a lot of admiration for him. And obviously, I love The Creator as well. I'm a huge fan of Gareth Edwards' work. And being able to see how Julian worked with him was really great. And hopefully, maybe Julian can help me get Gareth on the podcast at some point. We will see. We will see. Maybe we can all ask him for that. All right. Besides that, I have a couple of quick announcements. I want to let you guys know about this. Most of you can go to chaos.com to find this out. I've mentioned this a few times, but in case you're tuning in just now, V-Ray 6 Update 2 is out for Maya and Houdini. There's been a lot of updates in there, but the big one is going to be Material X. We've done a lot of work on Material X that has sort of affected both of those products, both our V-Ray for Maya and V-Ray for Houdini products, and it's a lot of work. It's pretty exciting. In fact, next week we will probably have an episode with our product managers to discuss all that, so stay tuned for that episode. But if you're interested and you would like to know more about V-Ray 6 Update 2 for those products, just go to chaos.com. Okay, also, I want to mention a couple events happening. All of these can be found at chaos.com/events. We've been doing more of the Nikos Creative Lighting workshops are available. There's going to be one in Toronto on April 3rd and one in New York April 17th. Again, to go to chaos.com/events. But I also want to mention that we will be at FMX. FMX is, of course, April 22nd through the 25th. And very exciting. Unfortunately, I probably won't be at FMX, but a lot of our Chaos people will be there, and there's going to be some really cool things there. I think we have a booth, some talks, a bunch of things going on. So just go to chaos.com/events one more time for all of that news and information about all the events that we're hosting. Now, of course, if you'd like to go to our podcast and learn more about that, our podcast page is chaos.com/CG Garage. If you'd like to follow us on Facebook, it is facebook.com/CG Garage Podcast. If you'd like to watch us, all of our videos are posted on youtube.com/chaosgroupTV, including these podcasts. And if you'd like to suggest podcasts, don't forget to reach out to us. We'd love to hear them. We've been getting lots of great suggestions, and we follow up on a lot of them. labs@chaos.com. And of course, any suggestions as well, you can just email us again, labs@chaos.com. But for now, please enjoy episode number 467 with Julian Levy.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
I have to say, you know, you were my first VFX producer, I believe.
Oh, no kidding. I know we were going to do it once a few years ago. I think maybe when I was still at MPC, I think. Yeah. So it was years and years ago, and I don't know, something we never ended up connecting and making it happen. But no kidding. I'm surprised to hear that.
Yeah. It was Day After Tomorrow was my first film. So that was when you were producing that, right?
I was the visual effects producer on that. That's right. Yeah. I've got some cheat notes here too. I'm like, I'm trying to remember. I know we're probably going to talk a little bit of history. So I started writing stuff down, and thank God I did. I'm like, because I'm remembering stuff as I'm writing it down.
Yep.
The memory starts to fade, as I'm sure you know.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, it was really awesome running into you at the VES Awards, and it's been sort of something I've been wanting to talk to you about for quite a while to just generally where your career is, but the creator in general. And I feel that there's something very important that's happening in recent years, or more, especially in the last couple of years, in the way movies are made and visual effects. And I think that someone like you explaining that and what the impact of these types of movies are going to be are huge. So I'm going to dive into that. But before we do any of that, let's talk a little bit about you and how you got into the movie industry and how you got into visual effects. Like how did you stumble into all this stuff?
Yeah, it's a long kind of little bit of a happenstance story. But so I'm from the East Coast, New York. And so went to college, William Patterson University on the East Coast. And I knew I wanted to, from a young age, I loved film, but it's not like that was my goal in life to be a filmmaker. I just enjoyed filmmaking and kind of entertainment in general. I was a big music head and I loved film. So I also was a little rambunctious as a kid, so I didn't really have my future goals in mind. I was just kind of living as it day by day. As high school was wrapping up and I was going to go to college, I'm like, all right, well, what? They said, well, what do you want to study? I'm like, and I ended up studying film and television. That's what my degree is in, which is kind of a rarity these days. Not a lot of people actually, obviously if they go to film school, but this wasn't a film school. Mm-hmm. But I got a degree in television and film. And so when I graduated, it's like, all right, I started going down the film. I had some great professors, film professors. And when I graduated, it's like, all right, how do you get into the film industry? And he laughs,
But was it literally like directing and like production films, or was it the business side?
School, William Patterson was interesting. They had a pretty good, they had their own TV station and their radio station. Okay. And they had a lot of live concerts, like big concerts. So for some reason it was ingrained in my head. I'll always forget. One of the classes was they had a big jazz program and touring bands would come through. And so one of the class was, each you recorded it for the television station, and each show you rotated positions. One time you'd be the technical director, one time you'd be operating camera, one time you'd be doing sound. And it was a great kind of cross section of how, things happened on the TV, kind of more the TV side of things. Mm-hmm. But then, I was also started making short films for the film courses. Nice. And I mean, totally Super 8, old school, old school. This is,
Do you know that they're making a Super 8 camera again?
I think I saw something about that. Right. And you could put like lenses on it, better lenses or something.
And it's got a digital viewfinder, but it still records on Super 8 film, which
that's
is very
awesome.
Interesting.
I mean, keep in mind, this was mid 80s. Right. Late 80s. Let's see, I graduated college in 88. So it was probably, 86 or 87. Editing was, you got your film back. You had a big bulletin board with pins on it, putting all your film clips on and editing with a splicer, for hours on end. And that's how you did it, It was it was definitely old school. So anyway, I graduated and I'm like, all right, how do I get into the film industry? I don't know what I want to do, but this is the path I'm going down. And so somebody said, there's a New York production guide. I was working after I graduated. I was bartending in Manhattan looking around for a job. They said, you got to get this New York production guide. And it's kind of like, it used to be called, there was one here in LA called the 411 or something like that, but it's basically all the production companies, editing companies, whatever. And so I was literally going page by page, calling the places that had the biggest ad. And I happened upon one place, R. Greenberg Associates, and called, and a PA had just been fired or quit or something. And they said, yeah, come on in. So I went in for an interview in a full suit and tie. You know, one of my best advice my mother ever gave me is, you know, you can never overdress for a job interview. It's a PA position, a runner position. I show up in a suit and tie and they're laughing, but I got the job. So I don't know how much you know about R. Greenberg Associates. I basically got so lucky. So R. Greenberg Associates was Robert Greenberg and his brother Richard Greenberg started the company originally doing title design, motion graphics, like big time, like Superman, the Superman titles that, you know, fly over you and, you know, you name it. For a period of time there in the mid-80s to mid-90s, they were doing every, you know, main title sequence there was, kind of like throwback to like Saul Bass, the old school style, you know, really imaginative title design. So I'll get to that in a second, but the company was all in one big building. They had a model shop. They were doing miniature models, like, you know, high-end miniature models for commercials and music videos. They had the title design department, the design department. They had optical. They actually won an Academy Award for opticals. So they were doing optical visual effects. And so they actually won a Technical Academy Award for the optical printer that they designed for to do the Predator effects. The original Predator movie, you know, that offset look of the Predator character.
And who was the person that was part of that? Wasn't that what, from Stealth?
Joel Hynek.
Joel Hynek.
No. Yeah. He was there. I was going to get to him in a second, but it was it was very interesting department, the optical printer guys. They were their own world. And Joel was part of that. But these guys, one guy's name was Eugene Mammut. I think he's the guy that actually won the award. And before he got to Greenberg, he was like a projectionist in Russia for the military. Like, I mean, these guys. So that optical printer it was the first one, I think, that could layer up to seven separate pieces of film. And then it had this offset thing on it, which is how they did the Predator effects. So they had that going on, and they had a live action division. And so I was like, I got into like a kid in a candy store. It was one stop shopping, everything about really early visual effects. And I was just a sponge. I was a runner. I was running around with the optical printer. That was your compositing. I mean, you sent the film to the lab, picked up the film. That was my job to start my day at Technicolor. Picking up the film dailies and stringing them up on the projector, and you'd look at dailies, and that was, you know, that was how it happened. But I was just a sponge, spending any minute that I wasn't going on runs or doing whatever in each of those departments, just like taking it all in. And it was just fantastic. And I didn't have that in mind when I went there. It just was the place I called that needed somebody. And so I just sponged it all in. And it was interesting because nobody was teaching this stuff at school because at the time, so they were one of the first companies to also switch to digital visual effects. And so again, that happened right in front of me. The switch from optical visual effects to digital effects was happening right, you know, underneath my feet, and nobody was studying it. Everything was on the job learning because the technology was just developing. So they very quickly, I had a choice to make. I was a runner or a PA for not that long. And they said, all right, listen, looks like you're going to last here. There were a few different options. I could have been like the assistant stage manager. The model shop was an option. And there was this new and growing department called Digital Post. And they said, you know, maybe Digital Post is where you want to be. And you start in the machine room, stringing up 1-inch tapes and making reels and, you know, just all of that. And so that's what I ended up kind of doing, and kind of worked my way up to what at the time was like an assistant editor, but it was like an online editor. It was like the equivalent of being in a Flame session, but our sessions were, it was based on, again, the technology was just developing. So, you know, we were working off of a Grass Valley switcher, a Kaleidoscope DFX machine, Abacus A64s and A60s, digital frame storage devices, and mastering to D1. And that was the, you know, that was your digital post suite. And I was the assistant to the main editor or compositor, really, is what he was. And doing all the prep work, you know, prepping mats and getting all the materials ready. And so Greenberg was also one of the first to start working with pretty sophisticated CGI. You know, just at the time when, you know, PDI was doing it, ILM was doing it, there were a number, bunch of companies that were kind of going that direction. They were doing, again, very sophisticated things for the time, motion capture and motion control stuff that it just, they were really pushing and trying to stay on the cutting edge of things. And I had a firsthand witness to all of that and was hands-on, you know, working on a paint box. I mean, I think our that's where I started on the paint box. But then worked my way up to kind of assistant compositing editor. Kyle Cooper. So he was, the design department was Kyle Cooper, was one of the ones who came out of that, who I'm sure you know from Seven and many, 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 many other things.
Big time.
Big time. Yeah. And Kyle's awesome. In fact, ironically, just worked with him on Creator. Full circle.
Wow.
Yeah. So Greenberg opened up this both happened about the same time. They opened up, they were doing more and more film visual effects work. They used to do just main titles, commercials, music videos, but then they started doing feature film visual effects work. Mostly at that point, digital. Optical had been kind of phased out. So in fact, the first they opened up RGA LA, which went on to become what is now called Imaginary Forces. The company still exists to some degree, but it was originally RGA LA, and that's where they were doing the feature film visual effects work. And so, like, the first project I ever worked, the first film project I ever worked on was Braveheart.
Yeah.
There's sequences, the fight sequences where the horses are jumping over the spears being held by the guys. They could only obviously do so much of that and only fake so much of it in camera. So we did a lot of horse damage, horses getting pierced. So there was a period in time when I was the assistant editor, and clients would come in for sessions, and there would be a producer with them, but the producer didn't really know what was going on. Again, all this stuff was evolving real time. But the producer would have the clients there eating their sushi, doing whatever they're doing, trying to explain to them what was going on. But as the assistant editor, I would constantly be the one turning around, explaining to them what's going on. Now's the point where you kind of need to decide this, what color this is going to be, lock into timings, because if we go back, it's going to take a long time or be more expensive. And so I was kind of the one talking them through things. And then these clients would come back and they just, you know, for another project, or the agency would or whatever, and they'd assign the producer, and they're like, well, no, we don't want them. We want that Julian guy. He's the one who's, you know, explaining stuff to us. So at a certain point, they pulled me aside and they said, you know, you seem to have an affinity for explaining things to the clients. Have you ever thought about being a producer rather than, you know, continuing down the path you're on? And so that was a pivotal point in my career, was I had to decide whether to go down the road of artist or hands-on, or switch over to the dark side, the producing. And I'll tell you, it was, I'm kind of a interpersonal kind of, you know, I enjoy speaking with people. And as the new guy in Digital Post and the assistant editor, I would be doing like the night shift. I would come in at 4 or 5, work overnight, doing all the prep work for the editors in this building by yourself, walking around, losing your mind. You're the only one in the building and you're having to do roto mats or whatever, putting music on or whatever, but losing your mind.
Relationship is the vending machine, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's kind of like reminding me of like The Shining. You know, I'd be walking down. Our building was on 39th Street, 39th and 9th in Manhattan. And it was this cool Bauhaus style, design style building. And, you know, you'd be doing something, but you need to walk away at a certain point. And I'd be walking down these hallways, just it felt like, you know, The Shining. I'm losing my mind. I'm talking to myself. I'm losing it. So I decided to switch over and move over to the production side of things, at first as a coordinator and then a production manager. And then very quickly, I was producing commercials and music videos and the feature film work that started coming in. And then, I mean, that was Greenberg. And so that's where I originally met Joel Hynek, doing some crazy stuff he was doing, you know, genius that he is. I was there for till 97. And then I got recruited. I got a call from a woman that I worked with there, was a bit of my mentor, named Nancy Bernstein, rest in peace. Had gone a year or so earlier, come out to California to work for Digital Domain. She originally started in like the commercial division, I believe. I think the intent was for her to work in film, but she started, I believe, in the commercial division, but I was recruited by Andrew Milstein, who was running the film division at Digital Domain at the time. And, you know, thankfully to Nancy, she gave me, she vetted me, they flew me out. And so it was at the time. So that was 97. At the time, Digital Domain was working on Titanic, Fifth Element, and Dante's Peak, all at the same time.
Which was, working on more than one film was really hard at that time, right?
Yeah. I mean, it was, I get there from New York. I had been to LA like once before, but this was, you know, here I am. It's like being called up to the bigs, you know, even though I was doing some film work and working on some, you know, high profile television commercials and music videos and stuff. This was getting called up to the bigs. And I get there and there's like over 1,000 people on the digital domain lot at the time, because they got the model shop going full bore on Titanic and, Fifth Element. You know, and Dante's Peak. There's this big bridge in the parking lot that, you know, that was part of the Dante's Peak, thing, and the motion control stages are going and all the digital artists. So everything going on, there was like over 1,000 people on the lot. And so the deal was, Andrew Milstein called me into his office. They flew me out and they said, here's the deal. We have this project that we really want to do. It's because of a relationship with the director, called Red Corner. And it's a small little film. And we just need you to push it through while all these other big films are going on. We need to get this done. Can you do it? And I'm like, sure. Yeah, I can do it. Sure. And so I don't know how much you remember about Red Corner, but originally it was supposed to shoot in China. They found out Richard Gere was in it. So they said, no, that's not happening. Richard Gere is not going to be associated with anything in China. And so they shot a bunch of plates over there, guerrilla style, incognito cameras hidden in bags and stuff. And shipped back like 10 containers of props and basically built this ramshackle Chinese village over in Playa, and that's where we shot it. So everything at the time, it was some pretty sophisticated work we were doing. So Kevin Mack was the visual effects supervisor. Yep. I'll never forget. So I went in, met with Andrew. They told me what the project was. I said, sure. And they said, okay. I went back to the hotel. They said, okay, we pretty much think you have it, but you just need to come back and meet Kevin Mack because he's the visual effects supervisor and we got to make sure.
And a character.
That, you know, yeah. So of course, in full Kevin Mack style. And I'm very good friends with Kevin Mack. We've done a bunch of films together, but I'll never forget the first. So I go back to Digital Domain and Kevin has arranged himself in the whale. You know, the whale, the big conference room. And he's adjusted all the lighting. So the lighting is all dark throughout the whale. And he's sitting on the far side from where you walk in at the end of the table with a light on him, just sitting there at the end of the table, as dramatic as it gets, right? Well, Kevin's putting on a whole show. And so I kind of see this and they told me, you can go into the whale. Kevin's waiting for you. And I get there and here he is on the far end of the whale lit up. And I'm like, Kevin? He's like, come in. And we ended up chatting about the whole thing, laughing. And we've since been very, very good friends. And that project was the first of many, many projects I did at Digital Domain, all having some matter of drama to them. After we did, and again, here at Red Corner, I pushed through. I'd go into these resource meetings and like Titanic, the digital producer from Titanic, Fifth Element, and Dante's Peak are there, you know, negotiating for resources. And I'm the new guy with this little movie called Red Corner saying, I feel like Oliver Twist. Can I have a CPU, please? But we ended up pushing it through and it went really, really well. Vernon Wilbert was the CG supervisor on it. And we did some pretty cool, for the time, 2D projection for backgrounds of where it's supposed to be in China and 2.5D, I should say, projections. It was very cool stuff. But then went on to do, I think the next project after that was this project called Supernova, massive project. Very dramatic because it was the end when MGM was kind of going down in flames. I think it was one of the last films that they did in that iteration of the original kind of MGM studio. Right. And it was a big deal. And there was a lot of drama involved, but here it was, you know, again, it's one of the first projects I'm doing that. And Walter Hill is the director. And it's, you know, it's like, how cool is this? I'm doing this big space movie with a bunch of stars and Walt having meetings with Walter Hill. But there was a lot of drama involved in that project. But it was very cool. Again, we did some very cool stuff. And then there was Day After Tomorrow, which, you know, I don't have to tell you about.
It's been discussed many times on this podcast.
So I won't get into detail. And Speed Racer and The Grinch, who also I did with Kevin Mack.
Stealth, which we worked on together too.
Stealth. I ended up getting a little bit of a reputation at Digital Domain for the producer. They would put on something that was could be a problem show, either because of the clients or just the situation that it's in or the schedule or something that is going to be problematic. It was a kind of a blessing and a curse, is that I was the guy that got put on the show that could potentially have issues. They were all, you know, in one, despite the problems they had, very, very cool shows with great crews and great supervisors. Worked with Matthew Butler a lot, Eric Nash, Kevin Mack, Brother. And they weren't all big. A lot of them were big films like Stealth, Day After Tomorrow, Speed Racer. But some were smaller. In fact, some of my favorite memories are a project called Oh Brother, Where Art Thou with the Coen brothers. Which Eric Nash was the visual effects supervisor on. And amongst other things that were cool about the project, it was actually the first project to fully go through the DI process,
Right.
Roger Deakins, who was the DP on it, worked with Cinesite and very closely with us, obviously, because the visual effects work had to fit right into the puzzle. And so it's kind of known, there's a bit of a disagreement whether a film called Pleasantville, I don't know if you remember that one.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, or Oh Brother were the first film, but it was actually, they did a slightly different process. It wasn't really a full proper DI process. Oh Brother was that. So some great memories about that. Then went on to do a bunch of the Clint Eastwood films we did, Letters from Iwo Jima and Flags of Our Fathers and Transformers. I was at Digital Domain for about 14 years. And so there was a lot of different iterations of the company during that period. It was really like working for, you know, three or four different companies. The original, when I got there, Scott Ross and Jim Cameron and Stan Winston. And then obviously when Titanic was done, Jim kind of moved on. And then there was a slightly different iteration of the company. And then at one point, this group that came in and purchased it with that Michael Bay was a part of, John Texter, yep, and a bunch of investors. They brought down a bunch of people from ILM, Kim Labrary, Mo and Leo, Cliff Plumer, and it was going to be a different type thing. And that kind of didn't stick for too long. But during that period, I did Transformers with Michael Bay, and man, that was a ride. And then, so yeah, at the end of the day, I was there for, you know, I don't know, 13, 14 years, something like that. And then the writing was on the wall. I think the company was just purchased by the first time it was purchased by a Chinese company. And I had gotten a call from some folks over at MPC, that had gotten my name from somebody, and it seemed like it was time to move on. And so I went over to MPC as a executive producer, ended up being there for like 10 years. And obviously MPC was very well known in the industry, working on a lot of stuff. They were just opening up their Vancouver office. They were primarily based in London, and they wanted to have a presence in LA, since that's where 95% of the clients were. And MPC had an advertising office in LA, but not film offices. And so they wanted me to head up.
Was Joanna going there
too?
Not
at the time, actually. We brought her in afterwards. So at the time, we had a small office over in Santa Monica where MPC advertising was. And we set up a film screening room there, where basically the concept was, since all the clients are here, bring them in first to engage with them and, you know, show them some stuff in the screening room, have them meet our supervisors via VTEL or video conferencing, wherever they are. Supervisors might be in London or Vancouver or wherever. And then once we're working on a show, they can come in there and have reviews in the screening room. And again, with the supervisor, wherever they are, if they're not in LA, if they're in London or wherever, they're on a video conference and we're streaming the stuff in, not streaming, but showing the stuff in the screening room, that it doesn't matter where the work is being done. The clients come in, they have a familiarity with MPC and, you know, establish a footprint in LA. And that's the point of why I was brought on. I saw an opportunity to push it one step further. I said, why don't we build a bunch of front end stuff that happens on a production, either before the show's even awarded or even before it's at the studio, have filmmakers come in. Our art department at the time was based in London, and there was no real pre-viz department. And all of our bidding and new business was done out of London. I said, why don't we move everything here, start a pre-viz, small little pre-viz company. Not to, you know, we don't want to be the third floor. We don't want to start doing previs, but have the ability to do previs and some art department look dev and bring our bidding people over. And this way we'll get the filmmakers in, again, sometimes before the project is even pitched to a studio, we're involved. We've done some you know, look viz or pitch viz is what we were calling it.
Yes.
Do some cool looking artwork, get involved in the bidding. And this way, when the filmmakers go to the studio, we're already kind of involved. Or if it is at a studio already, we're doing the same thing. But I said, let's move all of that front end stuff here to LA. And they went for it. We moved over to, larger offices in Culver City. And mm-hmm. that's just before that, or at that time is when, Christian Robertson was the head of the film department at the time. He knew I knew Joanna from Digital Domain, and we were looking for somebody to manage our visual effects supervisors. We had such a large roster of supervisors that mm-hmm. keeping track of who's on what project and for how long, when they're available again, and when films were going to be looking for a visual effects supervisor is, you know, at the time, Christian and myself and the head of the Vancouver group, Michelle Grady, were kind of doing that, but it became a project in and of itself, is basically managing the visual effects supervisor talent. And Joanna seemed like, you know, she could be a good fit for that. So she came over to kind of focus on that. But that model worked pretty well. And a lot of projects, you know, sometimes we wouldn't get the visual effects on it, but we'd do some cool look dev and previs or pitch viz or whatever. And, you know, projects are awarded to visual effects companies for many, many different reasons. Sometimes we wouldn't get it because there is a relationship somewhere else, or there's a business deal that needs to happen or whatever. And that's fine. So we would do some previs or art department work and not do the visual effects. All good. We've got a little bit of a fostered a relationship there that could come back. And in a lot of cases, it did actually lead to the visual effects work on some, you know, very, very big shows. I mean, NPC was doing so much work at the time I wasn't producing. I was the executive producer. But I had to have a knowledge of where all of the projects were at any given point in time, because I was the call. I'm the one that got the call. Here right. in LA, one, because of the time difference, or because I was the one involved early on in some of the projects, not all of the projects. A lot of the projects happened because of Christian and our visual effects supervisor's relationship with the filmmakers or the studio. But a lot of times I would get the call. So I had to know enough about where the project was to be able to speak to it and very quickly get the information that they needed. So, right. I mean, these, you know, it was, you know, the Harry Potter films and Jungle Book. And I mean, I can go on and on and on. Godzilla, which actually is where I met Gareth. We'll come around to that in a second.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
But I mean, just so many, many X-Men, Prometheus, Jack the Giant Slayer, World War Z, the Harry Potter movies, the Pirates of the Caribbean movies, they were, you know, anything that was a big visual effects movie, NPC was involved in. And then NPC started growing even further to be in Montreal and Bangalore, India, really, really grew. Technicolor, which owned the company, was getting more and more involved in various aspects of the business. Although during the early stages there, NPC did operate very much autonomously, and for good reason. Obviously, they were doing a lot of work. They were getting work and doing cutting edge work. Is like, why were they going to come in and break anything? But mm-hmm. You know, things changed a little bit. I think as I left, or towards the end of when I was there, Technicolor was definitely getting more and more involved. Yeah, that was, and again, I was there for about 10 years. After that, I did a short stint at Paramount. I had the opportunity previously to go over to the studio side, but never did mm-hmm. because I kind of enjoyed the hands-on part of it. But there was an opportunity I had over at Paramount because there seemed to be a new regime being set up, a new kind of reset happening. I knew somebody over there, Ryan Stafford, and he asked me to come in as a VP of visual effects during this shift. And it was interesting. I knew other people over there, Sherry Hansen, who I had known for years, working with J.J. Abrams and who else? She was over there. And in the period of time I was there, I ended up finishing like 6 movies for them, small movies. It was part of Paramount Plus, which was doing their kind of smaller films. And then I got a call from Gareth. So I had spoken to Gareth and Alan Maris, who is the visual effects executive over at New Regency, early on about this project, kind of. It wasn't going yet. They weren't sure what the schedule was. And I ended up taking the thing at Paramount. But then they circled back, and it was Alan. And he said, listen, Gareth wants to talk to you. This thing is happening, and we need a producer. So kind of last call. And I decided I had a call with Gareth, who, again, I knew a little bit from working with him on Godzilla when I was over at MPC. And I mean, instantly it seemed like an incredible project. They showed me a reel of stuff they had shot on this location scout. The DPs, originally Greg Fraser was going to be and he was the DP on the project, but because the project started and kind of stopped a little bit because of COVID, the schedule paused a little bit, and he had a previously, the schedule would have worked out that he did Dune, he did The Creator, and then he went on to do Dune 2, but Dune 2 started happening not earlier, I think, when it was going to, but Creator pushed. So Oren Sofer, who is kind of Greg's kind of protege, maybe that's not the right word, but worked very closely with Greg Fraser, was the kind of DP on the set. I mean, they would all look at the stuff together, but Oren was the guy on location. And he would review this stuff all the time with Greg, but so it was the two of them. So I saw this material. They told me Hank Corwin was the editor, very, very famous, well-known editor, did Terrence Malick's Tree of Life and legendary Natural Born Killers. I mean, yep. You know, these films that were just legendary films. And I looked at the stuff and I had a conversation with Gareth and I said, I've got to do this. So I spoke to the people at Paramount, again, Sherry Hansen, and I said, listen, I've got this opportunity. They wanted me to stay. It ended very cool, very amicably, all good. They were going through some restructuring anyway. So it worked out perfect. And that's how I ended up on The Creator.
Yeah, that's an amazing journey so far. And a really great thing. I mean, to me, I think, you know, what I am so excited about, you know, this project and what's going on is how there seems to be a new shift in the way that filmmaking is taking place and the way that visual effects is taking place and how people are looking at these things that are going on in the industry. And I think what's interesting to me, you know, as you mentioned, we on the Martini Giant podcast, we actually covered Monsters, Gareth, one of his first films, yeah. Right? Because we thought it was brilliant. He actually comes from a visual effects background. He did all the visual effects himself. You know, and he's so guerrilla style in the way that he approaches things that there's something sort of refreshing about that. And back then, Monsters was a long time ago. We thought that was going to be the revolution of films, right? Like someone is going to keep doing stuff. And we kept looking at people like Gareth and how he's doing things. So when The Creator came about, and this is much more his own sort of ideas, and you know, he owns a lot more of it. Not unlike Godzilla, which is its own IP and has everything else. This seems to be something that Gareth is much more has a little getting his hands dirty in a way of that. So my thoughts on that is like, you know, what are your thoughts about how visual effects are happening today, and do you see that the approach on visual effects of this movie, how different are they from the traditional way of doing visual effects in some ways?
I've obviously had a lot of conversations about this. A lot of people are asking about how we made the budget work and how we basically, you know, were able to make things work. And it a big part of it boils down to the filmmaker. We couldn't have done this film with a different type of filmmaker. I don't want to say we couldn't have done it with any other filmmaker, but a filmmaker that shared some of the things that Gareth has, the way he thinks about things. Yes, he has obviously a very good knowledge of visual effects. Now, but keep in mind, when he was doing it was a long time ago. Now, certain things are based in, you know, don't change theory, but the tools have changed significantly since he was on the box. And he's the first one to say that. He's the first one to say, listen, I'm no visual effects expert by any means. I think the thing that Gareth brings to the filmmaking process is knowing what's important to the viewer, not overcooking things. He knows it's not just his knowledge of what it takes to make the visual effects and how to approach things, but he knows there are options. And if he's looking at a frame or a sequence, and he knows this is where people are going to be looking, then he doesn't want to have to overbuild or overdo something, spend a lot of money equals spend a lot of money doing something that is either going to go unnoticed or is not equal proportionately to how much time and money you're going to spend doing it on what the viewer's takeaway is going to be. So that's why they shot a lot of things the way they did, to make sure that there was something in camera that visual effects would build on. But he didn't necessarily think some of these what appear to be very sophisticated environment backgrounds that we did. He was the first one to say, listen, if that's going to be in three shots or a couple shots, make it work from this angle, and this angle, giving us shots, working with I can't say enough about the production designer, James Klein, on this project. He and Gareth had this kind of iterative process that didn't involve doing sophisticated rendering, you know, iterations of the shot. They would get a frame and send it to the art department, and they would do a paint over of what needed to be where, what was important. Gareth would make sure that's right. And so before we actually started doing something fully on, it was kind of thought through in that art department paint over, is what they called it, iterative process. And so anyway, Gareth would say, if this thing is only going to work for these two shots, just do a 2D projection, cheat it and paste it on there. You don't need to build this whole thing to work from every single angle possible. And so that's just a very good, I think, explanation of where we were able to find shortcuts and different way to do something, and that equaled a cheaper, and not just, you know, a lot of people talk about the budget on this movie, but the schedule was very, you know, pressing too. I mean, the shot count grew incredibly. You know, originally ILM, when I first came on, ILM was going to do the whole show, and they were going to be the only vendor. And once the director's cut came in, and we did our, you know, myself and the visual effects editor and ILM did an assessment of it, and we're like, well, there's like double the amount of shots there. And so, you know, ILM did their assessment of cost and schedule, and you know, the cost was an issue, but also the schedule was an issue, because the studio needed to be done by a certain time, and they said, we're not going to go any longer than that. And so that was the bigger deal for ILM, is they couldn't get all the other shots done in time. So that's when they turned to me and they said, all right, Julian, you know, here's, you know, 600-700 shots that ILM aren't going to do. You need to find vendors to do them on this schedule and on a budget. And so when we present, when Gareth and I presented the work to all these other vendors, which I kind of opened up the old school Rolodex of everybody I knew, started making calls, see who had capacity at the time. We ended up with like 11 or 12 additional vendors beyond ILM in order to get the work done. And how we divided up was just a jigsaw puzzle of, you know, unfortunately, the film wasn't such that it had very specific sequences that you could divide it up. Or so, because then there were characters, if somebody was just doing the Alfie character or the Harun character, they could just do that, but they are in all different sequences. It's a jigsaw puzzle. And so mm-hmm. it was tricky to do it. But we did find vendors that we had them do some test shots, and they produced some great stuff. Now, that being said, a lot of that is because ILM did some incredible asset building and shared pretty robustly prepared assets with the vendors. Right. And we had some pretty good look dev done. So the vendors had some, you know, some good stuff to go off of. But all of our other vendors really, really rose to the task. So Gareth and I we also made the decision not to bring on an overall visual effects supervisor. You know, again, the other vendors, and for the 600 or however many shots that weren't going to be done by ILM, it wasn't really going to work for them to supervise that work time wise. It just, there wasn't time for that. And Gareth and I kind of sat down together and said, listen, Gareth made himself available from the get go. That was part of getting this movie done. Again, I said Gareth's style and the filmmaker style is Gareth is hands-on. He's like, you call me anytime to look at something, no matter what state it's in, and I will tell you if it's worth going. What drives Gareth nuts is when visual effects work is held back from the director while they play with it, fine-tune it, whatever, and then they show it to him, and he's like, no, that's actually something got misconstrued there. That's not what I was looking for, which happens all the time. It's just part of the process. Or just something is, they're overthinking something or whatever. And he beats himself up, but that's right. Part of the process he hates is because had I seen that 2 weeks ago, I could have saved two weeks worth of work going down a path that was unnecessary. So Gareth and I decided that for the other vendors, we would just be the ones dealing with it. Gareth is sophisticated enough to know what something needs to look at.
He was the visual effects supervisor, it sounds like.
he was, but again, for the shots that needed to be done between James Klein, the production designer, and the work that was being done from ILM, there was good... The world existed, and Gareth knew what the world should look like. And so a lot of the vendors that were doing like Alfie or one of the simulant characters, they would do a couple shots and, you know, we would vet it, make sure it looked right, you know, and then we knew they had 60 more of those shots. We're like, all right, make them all look like this. Gareth is not going to pixel fuck and frame fuck every single thing. He's like, he had a trust there that if it's going to look, now obviously he would look at them. But they were really good at matching a look. And so that's how we were able to move quickly and not have layers of reviews before. I mean, when I pitched the work to all the vendors, I would, me and the visual effects editor would present the existing work that ILM had done so far, a bunch of art department stuff, and reiterate to them that and convince them that the way to get this project done was not by overcooking it and overthinking it. If you can, and listen, I was on a budget too, so I needed to make it work in a very economical way to fit into the budget. And they're like, well, no, but we got to build this whole thing in 3D. And I'm like, no, Gareth is telling us if there's a cheaper way to do it, then we would need to explore that. He wants you to explore that. Do a 2D thing, do a 2.5D thing, whatever. Let's find different ways to do it. And so we prepped all of the vendors for that. And it actually played out. Gareth was on board with that. And again, that's why I say the style of filmmaker that Gareth is, there needs to be a trust and a commitment that's the way, that's going to be the process, that all of a sudden he can't, there needs to be a commitment to what is going to work. And in the 11th hour, he can't come in and say, all right, now I need to see that from this angle. And it's not built yet. It was done in like a 2.5D, not cheap, but, you know, different way. That mm-hmm. he knew that. He knew he made a commitment to that, and he was going to have to live with that. Right. So there is no, you know, people are coming to me saying, what's the magic bullet? What's the magic, you know, the secret pill you guys use to do such sophisticated, you know, rich looking work on the budget you did? And it was just, a lot of it was old school 101 filmmaking. Gareth and I would have long ass days. Because our vendors were all over the world. So we would have early reviews starting sometimes at 6 a.m. With our European vendors, work our way around the globe to the U.S., Canada vendors, and sometimes go super late to midnight doing reviews with our Australian vendors. And Gareth was available and on board to do all of that. It was organization. It was, you know, we had a lean, mean production team, production visual effects team that was, you know, constantly sending reference of stuff to all the different vendors to make sure what they were showing Gareth matched up. And there was a lot of real production 101 that made it work, and Gareth's availability to do those reviews. You know, all of those things combined enabled us to do what we did.
Yeah, I think it's really, really incredible. And I think, you know, if you look at the films, like I mentioned before, if you look at the films that are coming out, and especially now the ones that are nominated for VFX Oscars, right, like The Creator and Godzilla Minus One, I think you see those two films and you see that particular message, right? Like that message of just much more hands-on, right? Like Gareth was very hands-on into the creation of this and the visual effects that were going on. And the same thing with Godzilla Minus One. Those guys were very hands-on with what they were doing. And they weren't necessarily trying to reinvent the wheel. They just were very efficient in getting their vision across. And I think that's kind of a beautiful thing about filmmaking. It almost feels like real filmmaking again and not necessarily decision by committee, right?
Yeah, I mean that equals time and money layers, yeah. You know, and like I was saying before, that's something that Gareth wanted to, one of the things, and you can look at some of the podcasts Gareth's done in the last few months, and some of them are great, where he really explains his philosophy about spending money, shooting, going on location, and so I won't get into that part of it, but. Yeah, he. There's a lot of different ways he thinks about things that equal costs and time savings. And, yep. You know, a lot of big studio visual effects tentpole films are not made that way. And there's a lot of producers on some of these films. You look and there's like 20 different producers. And, there's layers, especially if it is a franchise universe, you know, that they're right. building upon, that everybody's going to have something to say. And, right. you know, Gareth, it's interesting because Gareth had was exposed to that, right? He did after right. Monsters, and Godzilla was probably the first foray into that. And then Star Wars. How many people you think had an opinion on things on Star Wars?
Yep. Yeah, of course.
He's seen the range of what it takes to do this kind of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, if you go back to Monsters and you see his what he spent his, and he spent very few dollars on Monsters, but what he did spend his dollars were go to the right location, opportunistic filmmaking, and generate the CG, the CG, and have direct control over the CG. And I think just that is really a beautiful, beautiful way of working. It's highly, highly respected, and I think that this is a good signal for people who are filmmakers that you can make amazing, beautiful things if you just are smart about how you work with these the details on it, right?
And there's two things. Yeah, I completely agree with you. But one is you need to be available. You need to be available to chime in at any given point to give your comment on things. And you need to commit early on. And a lot of times I don't think filmmakers, either because that's not the way they work or because they don't have a full vision of the film at an early enough stage, but there needs to be an early and full commitment to what something's going to be before you go down that path and start making changes to things. And that's all equals additional time and money. So, I'm sure the Godzilla guys, the director was a visual effects supervisor originally. They've become quite the darlings of the this year's visual effects films. They had a limited budget and a limited resources to get done what they had to get done. But they probably shares with Gareth knowing what's important, where to spend your money. Not spend money on something that the viewer is not going to appreciate and is not important. That's why I would say more than anything else, that's one of Gareth's incredible talents, is knowing what is important. There were kind of times where we'd be working on something and Gareth would focus in on some little thing in the frame, which kind of I'm saying to myself, why is he so hung up on this? That nobody's ever going to notice that. And then, months later, watching the finished film, I'm watching the film and my attention, as separated and as divorced as I can be from it, just trying to objectively watch the film. And I'm watching a sequence and a shot and my eyes go to this one thing. I'm like, son of a bitch, how did he know that that's where I was going to be looking? And he just has a sense of what in frame is important. And if you can have that ability and spend your money on what is important in the frame, you're going to be able to save a lot of money.
I think it's great. And I think it's sort of there are a few filmmakers out there who I think are very important. And it's a sign that there's a new breed of filmmakers, right? Who can understand things, right? I'm hoping that there's this, in light of the fact that we're going through obviously a dramatic shift in Hollywood with the strikes and AI and everything else, which we can get into. But I think that there's a new breed of filmmakers out there that have the ability to navigate those waters very well. And I think that, people with your kind of experience understanding how to get all the sauce working, but also someone like Gareth is like, what's the picture that I care about on the screen, and knowing how to prioritize those things or how to create the shortcuts that you need to make make that happen, So people like Gareth and Neil Blomkamp and all those guys who've done it,
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's got to be the right project, right? I mean, there's right. Unfortunately, there's a part of the decision making that happens in the film industry that is above and beyond all of that stuff we're talking about, and it's the financiers' risk. What are they willing to risk money on? It had been these big franchise films, the Marvel stuff, the Star Wars stuff, and all of the kind of the franchise stuff, and they were hesitant to approach a film like that with this kind of fresh approach to filmmaking. So where the two meet, I don't know. I certainly hope there's more of a shift towards films that are original stories and are not part of another universe. I mean, that's always going to exist. There's a huge... you look at the box office, well, most of the box office, not all of the, that's one thing that's happening. Some of these films that aren't doing well, that are part of these universes, I think are a little bit of a slap in the face, not a slap in the face, but a slap to reality that you can't just have it be part of an IP and assume it's going to do good business. Sure. It still needs to be a good film and needs to have something fresh about it. So,
but I think that also, if you look at what Gareth's doing and what you guys did with the budget, you lowered the risks for everyone, right? You make it
well,
possible.
But they didn't know that at the beginning.
Sure.
They didn't. So Regency took a big chance on this film. Here is an, you know, an original story. You need to know that your filmmaker is going to be able to, and the people doing the visual effects are going to be able to pull off what they're pitching. On a project that's not part of another universe. And like I said, all of those things, you're not going to be able to be changing your mind all throughout the course of production and post-production or whatever. And it's a big risk for, studios. Wow. Now with every one of these that has some amount of success, I think it will, encourage them to take more chances. Certainly yep. hope it does, but look, I mean, Creator is getting very a lot of accolades technically for the work, the visual effects work done, and filmically. It's a beautiful looking, rich looking film, but it didn't do gangbusters at the box office. Now, there's a bunch of different reasons for that. During the strikes, none of the actors could promote the film. That was kind of it. It kind of opened up against, of all things, Paw Patrol. I mean, who thought Paw Patrol is going to be like this big, you know, blockbuster movie, whatever, or whatever right. you call it. And so there's a lot of different reasons why it didn't perform at the box office. But, you know, as well received technically as it is, it didn't, you know, blow the doors off at the box office. So there's still some proving that needs to kind of happen. You know, similar to Godzilla. Godzilla was very well received. People say it's one of their favorite of the Godzilla films. But you know, it didn't break records at the box office, obviously. So there's a long way to go till this type of approach to these films is more widely received. But hopefully, with what we've done, we hope it pushes things a little bit in that direction.
Yeah. I think, you know, to me, there's this, it's interesting because as we've noted, you know, there's been some tumultuous times in Hollywood with the strike and the pandemic even, and all, you know, it's all been accumulating in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
But I think what we've been sort of looking at it on the Martini Giant side, where we nerd out about films, as you know, it's like in the 1960s, this was happening also, right? There was a downward spiral in the filmmaking and people weren't going to go see Westerns anymore. They didn't care about Doris Day musicals anymore. And the film was dying. And suddenly there were these weird independent films that were created like Easy Rider, et cetera, that sort of blew up, right? And it was because people were like, let's do something different. Let's do something of filmmaking from a much more guerrilla style approach. And that really sort of started the careers of all these great filmmakers, including, you know, Coppola and Spielberg and everyone. And to me, I've been looking for that moment, right? I've been looking for, like, there's got to be that moment in the films where we're going to start to see that shift. And I do think that people don't necessarily want to see superhero films anymore, the same way that they don't want to see Westerns anymore. And there are films like The Creator. There are films like Everything Everywhere All at Once and suddenly, like, Godzilla or these strange little Poor Things, you know, all these strange little films that are coming about that are much more from the heart and sort of original and also just creative, right? There's a creativity behind everything. And I find that very exciting. And whether they perform well in the box office or well, you know, they are impactful. I think they're impacting the way that people think about filmmaking. Mm-hmm. And it's really great. It's really great that people like Gareth and yourself are looking at these films and not sort of going like, let's roll up our sleeves and figure this out and make it work. And it's not necessarily a massive technological breakthrough. It's just proper eye and just doing it the right way, you know?
Story of filmmaking. I mean, hopefully I agree. And I hope they, two things. I hope, the people with the money are going to be more willing to take chances, as we talked about. But also, I hope these filmmakers don't look at these type of films as just a stepping stone to move on and do the big, you know, a lot of these a lot of directors that do these first few films that are very refreshing and unique and a different kind of thing. And sure enough, in 2 years, they're working on the next Spider-Man or the
next.
But
Gareth did that, right? He did that, and he stepped back from it.
Right, right. And that's what I'm saying. I hope there are more directors that are willing to continue to make those type of films and not always look at those type of films as just a means to get to the huge, huge budget thing that is and comes with all the baggage that it comes with. So hopefully,
I think only a few people have managed to do that. I think people like Joe Kaczynski somehow, I don't know what his magic is, but somehow he's managed to figure out how to ground himself in that perspective. And that's great. But I think that it is a tough thing. I think I've seen that a lot, but, we could go on for a long time, Julian. This has been amazing. I don't want to keep you too much on this, but thank you so much for being part of this. And taking us down that incredible journey of yours. What a story. What a story. It must have been really great to be at those places at that moment in time through all of this.
Kind of a bit of luck, you know, as they say, right place, right time. I mean, going back to our Greenberg Associates, I wasn't looking for the most cutting edge visual effects company. I didn't know I was going to be in visual effects. I wanted to be in film, but I just happened to, because a PA quit that day, got hands-on education to how visual effects happen. And then the moment in time at DD and then MPC and, I consider myself lucky to have just kind of happened into those timing.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Well, thank you so much for doing this. Thank you very much. Yeah.